KBOO Portland.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Politics, Protest, and
Potpourri.
I'm your host, Corelia, and
I'm Leslie McLan.
So, we have a special guest in tonight, a freelance journalist and former intern for Eugene Weekly, Mike Bibbins. Go ahead and say hi to the guests. And
Hi. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, let's see. What have you been up to recently?
Lately, I mean, I've just been kind of hanging out, laying low, not doing too much on the protest reporting or writing. I'm just kind of just, you know, collecting my thoughts and just, yeah, it was just, you know, there was a lot going on as far as the protests and, you know, writing about weed and more protests.
I've been taking a break,
frankly.
I mean, very active city for protests.
That's kind of how me and you, like, intersect pretty much because we're both kind of reporting on protests and, you know, cannabis here and there. So, yeah. So, but yeah, me and Mike have known each other for far longer than that. I'll let you tell it, actually.
Oh, yeah. Well, we both went to Benson High School, which is actually right around the corner from here on 12th. And I met Corey, and I don't remember which was first. It was either the PE class or the science class, you know, depending on which day of the week we'd go to one or the other. You know, Corey, he would show up to, you know, you'd lose points for not dressing down. Corey would show up in these big old boots and just stomp around, run track, do all that.
Yeah.
You know, he's a funny guy. Me, I was just trying to just, I don't know, huffing and puffing. I wasn't in shape, that's for sure.
Yeah, I remember when I started covering the protests and whatnot for the Vanguard, and then you reached out to my former editor, Anna, and you're like, I know that guy.
Is that Corey from, like, it was like 15 years ago?
Yeah. So, yeah, there's quite a few topics I wanted to bring up with you.
Well, you guys just mentioned huffing and puffing and all sorts of weed.
Yeah.
That makes me wonder about...
That was meaning I was out of shape. Like, I was just trying to huff and puff around the track, but I get you.
Yeah, but yeah, that just makes me think of other people, you know, puffing a lot of popular things.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
There's a couple hot topics going on with the vape cartridge concerns. Everybody is worried about several deaths that have occurred from tainted cartridges and illegal cartridges that have sold in the black market.
Have you followed that at all? What's your thoughts on that one? Right now?
I mean, well, it's kind of scary for one, but I feel like, I mean, like, I haven't followed it like too closely, but I mean, since I do follow the news, you know, obviously, you know, I have seen these alarming headlines, and it, you know, kind of just makes you think that we need to go even stronger towards regulation so that we don't have these things on the black market. And, you know, we need to be able to, you know, it needs to be legal so that we can study it, study the weed. And because there's still unknown compounds in weed. Like, there's things in there that we don't even know about that we will find out about. And they could be good or bad, or they could just be benign. But
I think for me, some of the concern is, when you say weed, my first thought goes to, like, the actual plant and flower. But the bigger concern here is what's being made from the flower. It's these concentrated...
Like, how it's processed.
Right. It's the concentrated stuff. It's the products that we're getting out of the plant. So when it comes to these weed cartridges, from what I've read, it's not just weed. It's also things related to nicotine juices that are also known as e-juices.
Refill vape pens. Yes.
And whether it's cannabis-based or nicotine-based, kind of these e-juices are the ones that are causing the issues.
Because of the stuff that's in them.
And specifically, it's a chemical, vitamin E acetate or something like that.
Yes, that's what I've heard.
Yeah.
And then I didn't mean to solely place the blame on weed. I mean, you know, I know there's, like you said, the Juul things. I mean, I don't smoke cigarettes, like, or, you know, nicotine. I don't F with nicotine. But I know that a lot of what you guys were saying, the you know, those deaths and just sort like lung problems, you know, I know that that is
I mean, there's any health expert is going to tell you that anything you're putting in your lungs that is not air is not good for the lungs, because they're not meant to process heavier particulates and all the elements that come into these juices that get broken down. The flavors that we're putting in there, what are they based out of? What do they break down to when we heat them up? And those are the concerns. I remember a few years ago when I heard horror stories about vape pens It was more from the e-cigarettes when they first hit the market. There were batteries that were blowing up because they didn't have good temperature control, or people were overusing them and not giving them a break. And there was also popcorn lung, where the superheated vapor and the superheated smoke that they would get from the contents would actually damage their lungs in a physical way to make it deform and cause something called a popcorn lung, like permanent lung scarring, and actually destroy the lungs.
It's terrifying.
These concerns haven't really gone away, and they've always existed from anybody that will smoke anything to put in their lungs. So those are just something that we're becoming more, we're spreading the awareness of. We're becoming more aware of it socially, that this has been occurring rather than being a rare circumstance. As these products are more commonplace, that's why I think these concerns are spreading. Because whenever you put something in your lungs, you have to worry about the damage, the scarring to your lungs, that getting black lung, those particulates that are going to reduce your ability to take oxygen in, right? And that's going to affect your blood pressure. It's going to affect your tissues all across your body, whether or not they're getting the amount of oxygen that they need to function. And you're talking about running around on track and PE and huffing and puffing. That's why smokers have a hard time running, is because their body can't get oxygen into all of their tissues.
I never smoked back then in high school.
Well, maybe you didn't, but that's just a common problem that smokers have.
I did.
And when it comes to these vaping products, the stuff that goes in these newer juices is less known than it used to be, because there's more companies out there than there ever were. The companies are not necessarily ones of longevity, and you may never be able to find out what they were really doing to create their product and what they're putting in it.
So I mean, do you think we need like greater regulation? Are we going towards that? More regulation?
No matter what, I think people are going to push towards some sort of regulation, because if it's not regulated, people want to have guidelines to follow.
It'd be more thorough testing and regulation.
That's where the regulation may lie. The question is what type of regulation are we going to be allowing? And the regulation may only involve testing. But more than likely, the regulation is going to come down to the consumer end, which means marketability and purchasability, accessibility. That's where the legislation, unfortunately, in my view, seems to end up when it comes to social product and social use products that you're supposed to be an adult and choose, once you're of adult age, what you want to consume and put into your life. And if you choose to vape e-juices, you take that risk. But I also think we need more studies, more knowledge, like you said, done to see what these health risks are, like you said, Mike, because we don't know everything that's in there. We don't know all the chemicals and what they break down to. We only just found out about this vitamin E acetate and that it breaks down. I've had conversations with my co-host here about these type of vape products before, and I know he mentioned something about how there was some sort of study about how some of the chemicals in there can break down into something like formaldehyde. Is that what you said?
So, yes, there was a study out of PSU's chemistry department. I actually found this right after our last episode that we explored.
A few episodes ago when we
explored the pot topic.
Right, and our first potpourri, I think, was episode number, six?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
So the study was basically stating that terpenes, when exposed to extreme heat, actually turn into formaldehyde, which... if anybody ever smokes out of a dab rig, one where you have to heat it up with the torch and use like the nail or whatever and drop the dabs in, those dabs actually have added terpene. And so I was looking it up too, and it says limonene.
Yes, limonene
is a terpene, and it actually reacts with ozone, which forms formaldehyde.
Ozone is O3.
So,
right.
Yes, and it's when it's exposed to extreme heat that the limonene actually turns into formaldehyde.
Limonene is actually a common terpene. It literally comes from lemons, just like pinene comes from, pine. Pinene is actually something, that's the reason why pine smells so fresh and piney. It's the pinene in there. That's the smells. Like linalool is from
that's also
lavender.
On the list, and pinene, and there's
myrcene.
A few others that are
myrcene saying. Is
there,
from peppers.
There's a ton of
myrcene.
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 I couldn't spell it.
And so I've been trying to get my hands actually on that PSU study from the PSU chemistry department. I haven't been able to find it at the moment. I'm waiting for classes to start up, and I should be able to.
Do you know who authored the study? Perhaps you can send an email to the author and ask.
I'm just going to go to the head of the chemistry department. And
I think you can request those from, like, the lab. I mean, not the lab, the library. They, you know, you can request, scholarly articles.
That's pretty much what I'm thinking. It's either at the library
I spent a lot of time in the PSU library. Is a great resource.
Well, it was only done fall of last year, so it's either it's at the library or I have to go to the head of the department and be like, hey, where's the study? Can I get a copy? But yeah,
well, when you get that study, we're definitely going to have another potpourri episode include it.
But another thing that I want to explore with you too is because you do a lot of the reporting.
I've reported, I would say, fairly in depth on terpenes. I mean, a few articles where I've mentioned terpenes. I'm disturbed to hear that. Things break down or terpenes break down into.
Conditions matter.
But then, what is it? I mean, but they're also breaking down into other things too. Is it the other things or is it? We just need more research, really. That's all. We just need lots of scientific hard research.
The hardest part because it's still listed federally as a schedule.
Oh yeah, federal. So it's on the feds to, you know, if we want to be safe with weed, you know, you got to legalize it federally so people aren't scared to do. So they can get NIH money for grant money for studies.
Well, so you've done a lot of reporting on cannabis and CBD terpenes and all that.
A decent amount. I'd say my fair share.
Okay, so when all these articles started coming out, I always seen them coming through, and they're kind of like vilifying cannabis and THC and all those vapes in the titles when there was the first thing was popping out because of the Willamette Week, and they're like. Dispensaries or owners don't even know what's in their dabs or vapes, and they don't even they're scrambling to remove products from the shelves and whatnot. And I'm kind of wondering what you were thinking of some of that reporting, because I mean I've gone to several dispensaries and they're saying they've only pulled one brand.
I was with you one day. We went into a Floyd's and they had mentioned that there was only a little bit of one brand they pulled out, but most everything was fine. And they only did that just to be cautious. They hadn't received reports, but because they were unsure is what they said, is they pulled it until they knew for sure.
Me personally, I felt it was just too preemptive for all those publications to be like, oh, THC vape's bad.
I mean, I didn't necessarily see that or pay attention to that, so I don't know a ton about that. But I'd say I don't know a bunch about
recalls. Read a few articles, I noticed that they were mentioning cannabis vapes and nicotine vapes. They wouldn't really go very in-depth about the fact that the majority of these cases is out of the black market. That's part of, I think, why they're calling it mysterious, is because when it's from outside the regulated market, they can't get the information as readily. They can't understand it as well. And if these were simply really obvious manufacturers that they could go straight to and find the product and shut down the manufacturer or distributor, then it would be a cut and dry case. It wouldn't be a mystery. But because there's so much black market, that means that these are people that you can't track down easily. Mm. There isn't consistency because they aren't regulating themselves in that way. And they aren't testing things. You don't know if they are making the wax shatter, or you don't know if they're making these oils that they're filling the vape cartridges with at home and what they're using, how many hands it's been through, how old it is. So you don't know any of that. And I think that's part of what the mystery really is. But the articles aren't going in depth. Most articles are just discussing the general concern that the public has about the fact that e-cigarettes and vape devices are sold everywhere. And I think that's slightly misleading, in my opinion, because it's putting the focus on the fact that these are readily available consumer objects when the problem that exists is in a relatively minor amount or a small percentage of these products. And they aren't necessarily the legally available ones that the majority of consumers are engaging with.
Yeah, I feel like if a popular brand in regarding recalls anyway, which I swear I haven't heard anything about a recall, but what is it? If it was a big brand that was really hurting people, I feel that would have come out or it would have been reported on. Maybe it will be reported on, but
maybe it will be. But I think that's part of the mystery is that it's not as cut and dry as just finding the brand or the distributor. Yeah. That it has to do with.
And it's like, what else are these people doing? You know, is smoking, is vaping the most bad thing that people are doing? It's like, what else are they doing that's fucking their lungs up? You know, are they breathing? Are they breathing highway air? Or you know, maybe they live outside of a, you know, four lanes of traffic.
Well, I mean, you know? I know a lot of these guys are not only like vaping. They're also dabbing. They're also smoking regularly.
KFC,
and they may not
McDonald's,
be brand consistent.
Like,
and that
they're
brand
chugging
inconsistent.
Mountain
Dew. Unhealthy.
Brand inconsistency can cause a problem, because if these products are made differently, like when it comes to cannabis vapes, your CO2 versus distillate, whether that's how it's produced and how pure, you know, the actual cannabinoids in there are. Well, if you're smoking different brands and different products and mixing all the different types of smokes, you are adding a whole different cross effect to your body's ability to process everything and clean it out. I think that causes a problem.
And one thing that I have written about, back to the terpenes thing, I'm sorry that I've forgotten about that, is that people are, the weed has terpenes in it naturally, right? But during that distillation process that you mentioned a few seconds ago, Leslie, you know, they distill it and then they'll add the terpenes back in.
Right.
But a lot of the time what they're doing is they're not even adding, they're not adding cannabis-derived terpenes back in. They're adding non-cannabis-derived terpenes.
Thank you for that.
And it notes that on a lot of the packaging. You got to study what you're buying.
So when you see those vapes that say they've got watermelon, orange flavor, lemon, all of that, say that they've got the terpenes back in them, they're deriving
10%
those flavors
terpenes.
From those other objects.
Like,
they're actually getting like the grapefruit one and citrus from other places.
It's like a grapefruit was never meant to be smoked.
So something I noticed was
you could make a grapefruit into a good bong, I believe, probably.
Most fruits you can. You'll dry it out, and it makes
or
it taste...
Or a pipe, or, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you smoke out of an apple, you can't smoke out of grapefruit? Come on now. But I feel you.
If you do it right, you can. Like, especially since oranges have slices, if you can figure out to remove sections while keeping the rest, you make it a lot easier.
It's like artwork, though.
I know the brand in town named, like, Grown or something like that, and they do CBD derived from, like, pine or something like that. I mean, it's everywhere. There's multiple sources, and that's what's really troubling to me is that, because this plant is the one that's got the most compact form of all these different things, it's the one that's vilified.
And I'm not saying that necessarily, because obviously I don't know, I'm not saying that adding the terpenes back in is killing people or going to hurt people, but just from reasons that I like, when I talk to these people in industry, they say, no, the whole plant is better, you know, weed-derived terpenes are better. You know, and the science is not there when they say that, well, trust me, but it's like, it just makes sense. You know?
So one way to notice that is when I noticed that so many growers, it was last summer, I believe, there was a strain called Tangy that was everywhere. It was all the shops. It was all across town.
Tangyland, right?
And the thing is with this is that there were so many growers that you could look at the actual flower and see that it was a different plant. They came from different places, but the smell was exactly the same. It was spot on. And it was crazy to me because I actually went to a store. I went to like New Seasons or something like that. There was those health stores and into their section. And I went to go and smell the organic oil, right? And I smelled the citrus tangerine oil, not the orange oil. And it smelled like the Tangy strain. And I connected that what you had just said, that they're putting non-cannabis derived. They're just finding a cheap
derivative
that has the similar thing so that you're supposedly getting the similar effect, but it's not. It's like a Frankenstein distillate all of a sudden.
It's like, I don't know what it is, but, you know, it's fishy.
I shouldn't be able to go to the health food store and pull off the essential oil in the little jar, unscrew the cap, and smell the Tangy weed strain from all across town, anywhere from that pale green color to that dark, anything from fluffy and really keefy to just more outdoor grown and rough. There's a whole variety of what the buds looked like, but they smelled exactly the same, like the oil extract. And it kept giving me the idea that many of these growers might have actually been sharing information online through forums. Someone got the idea to go and find a non-cannabis-derived terpenes, such as the essential oil extract, and put that into their plant during the growing phase so that it's, you know, add it to the water, nutrient base, or something.
I've heard of people doing that with, like, with flavoring. I've only ever heard.
And that way they can say that the plant grew with that natural flavor and it wasn't added to the weed or added to the mix. They could say that was part of the plant. And then the seeds that grow from that, they kind of, like, make a new strain. So I figured that out last year, actually, with that one strain. It kind of like blew my mind. I felt like I ran across an article describing what you had mentioned about how people were putting in the non-cannabis derived terpenes. That clicked for me altogether. So I wish I could find that right now.
Yeah, it was one of I know it was in a Willamette Week. Although no, it was a little bit further. But I mean, this one was on terpenes that you're showing me. I'm sorry, folks. We're just flipping through the webs.
Trying to find the right one.
Oh, here we go. Are. Yeah, it's like the article is Understanding Terpenes is the Future of Cannabis Consumption, so why does Oregon not require testing for them? That's the name of the Willamette Week article that I did on terpenes. What was that? That was actually a while back. But, it's basically saying that, like, you know, some people, some people are more upfront about the terpenes and just what they're selling, and other people, they don't really want to talk about it, you know. If someone's selling concentrate or distillate or whatever with non-cannabis-derived terpenes, you know, I don't think, you know, if you put somebody on the spot with that, that's not a comfortable conversation for them to engage in you with. Where if they're being upfront about it, like, look, here's all the percentages, here's as much as we know about this bud, we got the terpenes listed on the side, which costs extra money to test for that. The labels cost money. They have to adhere to the state's regulations.
Yeah.
But right now there are no, like in Nevada,
and I know that there's like a total separation between the medical and the recreational, because like the medicals are ran by the Oregon Health Authority and the recreationals run by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So I imagine that there's probably like a totally different regulations on either end. So I'm not sure, you know.
I have to imagine that when it gets properly legalized at the federal level, that there's going to be the medical side of it is what's really going to push it. Into that legalization factor. And I think then it's going to fall under a whole different, you know, we're not going to have the liquor commissions anymore having control. We're going to have that under the health authorities of each state.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Well, like once the big businesses, you know, what you're talking about, once it gets federal, you know, all the big businesses who can come in and big healthcare, you know, come in and make money on it. And but right now it's like it's just very not a black market. It's just not – it's underdeveloped, you know. Like Oregon, you don't have to test for terpenes.
It's what's known as a Wild West scenario.
Wild West. There we go. In Nevada, I mean, they – you know, you have to – the state requires that you list the terpenes. And down there it's like you can't just like look at the bud, you know. Oh, do I want to buy that? You know, it's prepackaged when you get it.
In Washington, it's that as well. In Washington, it's prepackaged. So you can't – or at least most places when I went up there to legalize, I want to see how they did it differently. And you could just smell things like you can in many shops in Oregon. Most of the places here in Portland, you can say, oh, let me see that. And they're pulling it straight out of that jar and you're right there and you can really look at it. Once in a while, I've actually been at a place that let me touch a little sample piece. Like every time they'd get a batch, they'd pull out a little nug until people destroyed it and let you touch it so you could see how squishy it was and stuff. They won't let you have any access to something like that in Washington. It's all prepackaged.
Under lock and key, already sealed up. Can't even really look at it.
They're
all
prepackaged as for size as well. So I went to a variety of shops just to see. And if I wanted 1 gram, 2 grams, 5 grams, they're prepackaged. It's up to the grower and distributor to decide, I'm going to only sell this amazing Blackberry Kush in eighths and quarters. And then I'm going to sell my Durban Poison as an ounce. And half ounces. And they can do that. They can choose how they want to sell those strains. And that's what I mean by it's a little bit of a Wild West. I mean, almost every level when it comes to cannabis is a little bit of a Wild West because every state and every jurisdiction within the state has the authority to do it a little different and take it into control for how it's going to work for their area, which
is complicated. Frankly, whenever I'm putting these weed articles together, when I have to go and like look at the Oregon administrative rules or you know, look into what Nevada's doing or what Colorado's doing. It's a headache because the laws change and there's just so much. I think Oregon, I don't want to say it's overregulated, but I mean, there's a lot going on there that when you look in the rules, you're like, man, this is a headache and you could screw up and do something illegal, you know.
Very quick.
Kind of.
There's a lot of confusion about like ownership and like if you want to run a dispensary or have ownership in a cannabis related business, whether it's testing or the consumer sale end. You have to really go through a lot of hoops. There are certain restrictions. I remember very early on into some of the regulations after it got legalized in 2015, there were some rules saying that at least 50% of the owners or partners in the business had to be a resident or something like that. There were all sorts of weird little rules that changed, and they changed very quickly, that a lot of people that wanted to jump in the industry right away were more on the mom-pop, small-scale side, and they put all their eggs in that basket early on, and then when the rules changed, they didn't have money to keep up with them or to adjust their business plan, and they unfortunately got scooted out of the market because of that. And there's a lot of discussion from home growers and people that have been lobbying and fighting for cannabis to become legal for decades that are now pushed out of the industry. I remember following the story of Paul Stanford for a while because he had a lawsuit issue up to and including like his name and it being used because of some issues. That's something that you'd have to go and look up. There's a whole situation going on, but Paul Stanford was one of the early advocates, like Jack Herrera, who now is got a legendary strain named after him.
And one of my friends actually owns one of his bongs, so yeah.
Did you know that there is another push? I know this happens a lot, but there's another push for legalization at the federal level. There was a Washington Post article that came out on September 20th, and it was written by Paul Armentano, the deputy director of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. It says that the D.C. Council is considering a bill to fully legalize marijuana and regulate the retail marijuana market. The council decriminalized minor marijuana possession in 2014. Later that year, voters approved an initiative that removed penalties for the private adult possession and personal cultivation of cannabis. Some might opine that these decriminalization policies are enough, but for lawmakers to truly address the ills of cannabis prohibition, legalization is necessary. And so there's a whole article there about why that would be a benefit to society if we could really get that changed on the federal level.
See, I know you've been doing like a lot of this reporting locally on this situation too, about the cannabis around town, terpenes and all that. I'm kind of interested how, like you're already talking to, who's this, Jonathan Modi from the Oregon Health Authority.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking to all these really important people that know exactly what's going on within this, and like, have you had any chance of having conversations about this with them? Like,
I mean, like off the cuff conversations. I mean, not really. I mean, they kind of play their cards really. You know, they hold their cards tight to their chest. And the thing is like, a lot of the times when I hit up these people, they say, you know, I have to look into this and I'll get back to you. And so, I mean, like with terpenes, like when I talk to this guy Modi, you know, I won't say that he's, you know, they didn't seem like they knew a lot about, I don't know that he'd ever heard about terpenes before. And I mean, I hadn't heard about terpenes until like, what, maybe 2017, I think. I mean, this is new to everybody. Well, not everybody, but a lot of people, a lot of this is really new too.
So I really started learning about it in 2015 as it came up for legalization, and that's when I found out about terpenes.
I was like, terpenes? What the hell is a terpene? It's like some crazy marketing gimmick or what? Well, that's what I thought it was.
I just learned the connection between like one or two, and I think it was either lavender, which is linalool's terpene, or pepper's terpene, which is myrcene. So like black pepper has that myrcene, and it does good things for the body.
It's
like it really helps the muscles relax.
It helps.
So have you heard of
anti-inflammatory?
Have you heard of flavorings yet?
Flavorings?
Yes.
Enlighten me.
Flavorings are the flavor, basically. They're a partner to the terpenes.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I thought that terpenes are part of the flavor profile.
They are, but there's also flavorings. Yes, it's a thing. I did some reporting of the International Cannabis Business Conference, and there was like so many tables. I mean, that was for the Vanguard. Did you ever work for the Vanguard? I mean, no, you worked for the Sentinel.
I mean, I did like freelance, not a freelance, whatever, contributor, whatever they called it. I was doing like sports news for them and like crappy opinion pieces, which I got tired of that because I'm like, they just want me to write stuff that like, you know, pisses people off and I don't want to be that guy. And plus, I was more interested in doing the news anyway, not that they were just trying to pigeonhole me into doing that and not giving me my chance. So I just started bugging the sports editor there. I was, hey, man, let me write this story on this boxing, jiu-jitsu, MMA. He got tired of that, but I got enough out of it so I could springboard from that to other freelance stuff.
And, like, across the hall, too, because you did some work for the Sentinel, wasn't it?
Yeah, but, I mean, by the time I did that, you know, my freelance thing was rolling, and I didn't – it was important work, but it was largely about the money. But eventually I had to say, you know what, I got to let this go because, I mean, there's some stuff I can't talk about, but, you know, I felt like I wasn't able to do what I wanted to do or what I needed to do. And so I had to go and do that, and I couldn't do it there.
You were limited. That's kind of where I was.
And plus I was like pulled in all these different directions. I was like, man, I can't, you know, even what I was able to do, I wasn't able to do it to the most, you know, as good as I could, because I was just so busy. So I was like, okay, I just got to go and focus on these other freelance projects.
So a lot of the stuff that we've kind of crossed when we were doing reporting was the protests here in town, between Antifa, Proud Boys, Patriot Prayer. I mean, you've been following this whole thing since, I think it was pretty much from the start, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, I figure all this has been here. It's just been kind of like latent, just kind of like, you know, barely noticeable, kind of like an undercurrent. And then once Trump got elected, it just boiled over and came back to the surface and manifested itself in the physical form downtown Portland on a regular basis and other places in the region. But really the first time I saw like left-wing versus right-wing extremist violence was in 2016 downtown by the Salmon Springs Fountain. Is that what
Salmon
that's called?
Springs, I think
Salmon,
it is.
Salmon Creek? Fountain, the main fountain downtown. By that World Trade Center. There were left-wing people. They scheduled a flag burning on Facebook and were like, you know, we're going to burn this flag. And then predictably, the right-wing people came out and fought with them over it. And I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And it was kind of similar to what was going on lately in the, you know, all this goes on downtown and the police don't do a whole lot, but sometimes they do. But, back then, they let them fight for, like, you know, 40 or 50 minutes down there. I mean, you know, it would jump off, pop off, then, you know, there'd be a break, then they'd do it again. And, like, once a huge crowd started to gather around, then the cops were like, okay, you got, you know, enough of this. But when there was just a few people, you know, 5, 6, 7 people fighting, they're like, I guess they let, you know, they figure, hey, it's a petty squabble. We'll just let it play out.
So
crazy.
What's the craziest thing you've seen firsthand? Because I've been beating myself up because I remember, if you remember, I was there for May Day, but I had to leave for class after a little while. I'm still beating myself up that I didn't stick around because I know you got some good footage from Cider Riot thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. But I mean, the craziest thing I ever saw at we're talking these right-wing versus left-wing type of protests.
Or any protests, really.
I mean, the craziest one I saw is when Mike Strickland, the Laughing at Liberals guy, you know, he pulled a gun on the Black Lives Matter.
I remember you got footage of that.
From the Don't Shoot, it was a Don't Shoot PDX rally outside of the Justice Center, and all I heard was, he's got a gun.
That's crazy. Then,
you know, I was like, oh man, my phone, the footage is full. I got a live stream. So I started a live stream. Reporters were ducking behind cars. Rightfully so. I mean, that's the natural reaction. But I was just like, yeah,
you're just standing there filming.
And plus, like, here's the deal. I didn't feel threatened by that guy. But, you know, obviously, whatever he had going on with those people, like, wow, he pulled a gun on these people. You know, he put it away. But in that moment, I was just like,
holy cow.
Wow. I never seen anybody hold a gunpoint before until then.
Did you see any of some of the climate strike protests that went on the 20th in downtown here in Portland?
I saw some tweets, you know. There was some action on the Hawthorne Bridge, I guess.
Corey was down there.
Yeah, I was down filming as they were going to march up onto the Hawthorne Bridge. I should have gone up to the Hawthorne Bridge, but I was like filming the entire crowd. It was literally live streaming for like 20 minutes, dude.
That's a popular bridge for protests just because it's easier to go in the street.
There also ended up being like a skirmish between a small faction of like Youth Liberation Front or Antifa's that was down there clashing with DHS over at the ICE facility and whatnot.
Wait, what happened with the far right dude? What was his name? David Willis Bombs, who he got pepper sprayed?
I have no clue what was going on there.
Like, but you saw those pictures,
I saw
right?
the pictures the and I kind of yeah. heard it in the periphery, but I was like, no context was really given besides David Willis gets pepper sprayed, and I was like,
and then a cop got it too.
Yeah, and the cop also got it, and so I was starting to wonder, because there was like when I was down there just before the entire march of the climate strike started in March, there was a Youth Liberation Front and Antifa mix that ended up doing like a whole half block circle around and got to the front of the climate strike procession, and then after about like 30 minutes of people building up behind them, they left and started marching up towards the Hawthorne Bridge. And it was thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people. I mean, you How covered
many thousands?
I had to estimate it was over 5,000 easy.
That's a good number.
You were there.
A strong number.
You covered, I believe, the August 4th one
here.
Last year, and then you were also, didn't you?
Most of the big ones.
Yeah.
Except for the one where Andy No got, he got roughed up.
Oh, you weren't with us on the 17th of August.
No.
Right.
That was probably the, but even then, was that one ginormous, or was it, like, I felt like what I was seeing from the videos of that, it was just like a lot of just compact action, you know.
That's what I felt about it on the 17th as well. Like, it wasn't.
Like I was surprised that all that happened, really. I was like, whoa, man. But, I mean, it's a summer. It seems to, like, you know, really pop off in the summer in downtown between these protesters. So, I mean, it's raining now. Maybe it's all going to stop for now. But next summer, holy crap.
Yeah,
you know?
So that's kind of what my next question for you was, like, so you've been covering it for this long since, like, the election, Donald Trump, and everything's been clashing. Would you say that it's getting worse, if it's fizzling out, if...
I mean, every time I've thought to myself, like, oh, is it going to stop? I feel like it's cyclical, you know? It's like, you know, the ebb and flow, the tides, they go in, they go out, the protesters, they come out for the good weather.
Out of all the protests that you've covered, could you like, what's the first one that you think of that you go back to you enjoyed? Like, what was the most enjoyable protest for you to cover?
Oh man, I don't necessarily know that I enjoy any of them, because I mean the thing is like, I know I swear to God, when I covered Trump down when he went to Eugene in 2016, I was out there, and I swear to God, I had like heat exhaustion or something. Like I hitched a ride. Here's a crazy thing: I had scheduled a hotel there, you know. And then I was like, oh, I feel much too sick. Like, I got to get home. I begged these activists to give me a ride, you know. Mm. I was like, please, like, I need to get back to Portland, you know. And I was like, man, there's a chance they might kick me out on the side of the highway or something, you know. Because, I mean, it's me. I don't know, you know. I never know what people are going to think of me. And so we had to stop in some restaurant. And then, you know, I'm, like, broke. I pay in change for my fries, you know, because I spent a lot of money at that frickin' hotel.
And possibly then, having a medical emergency.
Yeah, and so I'm like, oh, you guys, God. I'll be right back. So I go in the bathroom, and I'm puking, like, in the bathroom, you know. And then I go out, and I lay down just, like, on the asphalt in the parking lot just because I'm, like, burning up. And I'm like, so, yeah, it's just stuff like that. Like, you know, I get these killer headaches out there. You know, you got to limit your food and water intake so you don't have to leave and use the bathroom. It's like almost like a religious experience because, you know, you put everything aside. Yes, legit. I feel like it's like sometimes it's like a religious experience because, you know, you're like hurting your body, you know, for the greater good. Like, it's not healthy to be out there, like, at all for a reporter, I feel like. It's just not – particularly enjoy. I mean, when people, okay, the MMA thing, that was kind of cool outside the cider riot. That was kind of like the MMA fan in me came out. I'll admit.
Oh, those two guys literally squaring
off. The May Day riot that Joey Gibson has the lawsuit against him for.
Yeah, have you noticed that it's up for sale now and all that? What's your thoughts on that one?
Yeah. That right, it went up for sale, cider riot,
as
of Wednesday.
I mean, I feel it, you know, just say, hey, I want to walk away. I mean, I've never spoken to the owner that I know of.
I've talked to him a couple times since then.
You know, it's hard for me to get inside his head and feel what he's thinking, but I don't know what I would do in that situation, but getting out makes sense. That's scary stuff. And, I mean, that wasn't even the first time that, you know, far-right activists have shown up there, you know? And, I mean, they could just show up at any time, you know?
Well, they can show up anywhere because it's a public place in many ways. Until they incite violence.
But
when you're starting to instigate violence and harm to people, that's where the problem is.
I mean, and maybe not even harm, just like showing up and just say, hey, F you, or oh, down with Anti, or just, oh, we're here, and just like making a scene outside. That's bad for business, you know?
If you're trying to make other people uncomfortable, you are literally, you're not trying to spend time on creating value for your moment that you're experiencing in your life. You're expending that energy to harass somebody else's moment in life. And that's still causing harm and inciting a certain kind of violence.
But back to your question about the enjoyable thing. I mean, I don't know that I enjoyed that MMA fight, but from, like, I'm a sports fan, MMA fan.
It piqued your interest.
You know, I was just like, whoa, these guys are squaring up and having a relatively, I don't think it was a fair fight. The one guy was really out of shape and his knee was busted up. But, you know, hey, when two people agree to fight, you know, that's on you. It's like, that's on you.
Yeah.
That's on you. And
I didn't see any of that actual you know, riot or brawl that happened for May Day. I've just been reading about that incident ever since. So that must have definitely been crazy to just watch that unfold right in front of you.
I mean, it was definitely crazy, but I mean, it wasn't like, I mean, like when that girl got clubbed in the head by that jiu-jitsu guy, Ian Kramer, you know, that was like, what, maybe a half hour after the, you know, that initial skirmish where they were throwing stuff back and forth, which was like, it was crazy because you think, oh, they're throwing a cup. Oh, you know, but then clunk, here comes a big rock, and you're like, oh, whoa, like, you know.
This is escalating quick.
This is crazy, you know, even though it might seem like a joke, like, oh, you just splashed in with water, or oh, you threw a sandwich at somebody, you know, that's ha-ha funny, but then you throw a rock, and, you know, you get the mace out there, and it's sad and funny.
Is it very common to be seeing at protests, not just brawls like that, but at actual protests in, like, downtown or something, is it very common to be seeing people throwing things or inciting violence? Or is that just, you think, happen due to whatever circumstance that unfolds in the moment?
I mean, throwing things, I mean, you know, projectiles are a classic weapon, historically. Yeah. I mean, you know.
I feel me and Mike can both answer this one to a different degree. I mean, you covered it a lot longer than me. Yeah.
And then
I start thinking of Monty Python and throwing things.
You know, pies.
They got slingshots. I've seen slingshots used. You know, we're talking old school stuff. You know, the slingshot, just throwing rocks, clubbing.
Bricks.
Just clubs. Yeah.
I've seen piss bottles. I've seen water bottles.
See, that's the thing. I'm sorry to cut you off. For all the times I've heard people, I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm sure, you know, it has happened at some point, but I've never seen, like, from either side, you know,
a piss
pee
bottle.
Or, you know, a thing of shit.
Certain things that are just really gross.
Yeah. I've never seen that, like, but I've heard of it, and I'm sure it's happened at some point. That's really grimy.
That takes some planning ahead of time, I think. I mean, it's one thing to spit on someone in the moment.
During the August 4th rally, when I don't know if you... Yeah, you remember. You were the one that brought the picture in the Willamette Week of me doing video of the August 4th last year.
Oh, yes.
And so during that one, I was one of the last people that had gotten pushed back by officers to the back of the line. And there was, like, a few different projectiles that came over my head. I remember one water bottle and then one that hit a post next to me. And luckily, I got out of the way of it splashing everywhere. But, yes, it smelled like piss.
Which side was it coming from?
It was Antifa and those guys hurling it.
I mean, and, like, here's the deal. I don't want to, like, put one side on the other. But I've, like, outside of, like, I'm, you know, I don't doubt that what you said happened, Corey. And, but outside of the Occupy ICE thing... A lot of those people were saying that, you know, the right-wing people drove by and threw a thing of, like, it was either shit or piss.
They
or
did.
Something. And, like, so I've seen that. I believe that both sides have probably done that at some point. If we're just weighing the odds, you know. Here's the thing. The right-wing people, they like to focus. Like, that's a regular thing. Like, that is not regular. That is extremely rare. Okay? Because, like I said, I've never seen it. I can't independently say, you know, that. So if I haven't seen it, then you know it's rare.
I don't know how much coverage you did of Occupy ICE. I was there for, like, every week, constantly doing interviews.
Quite a bit. I mean, yeah, I was on I did a KBOO thing, like, live. I forget who it was, but couple hours after they swept the camp, they had me on there. But really, I mean, once the, here's the deal. I only went through that camp, the actual camp, maybe once, and it was just a cut through real quick. And I didn't go back in there until deep into the occupation, just because I was like, whoa, that's clearly, you know, that's occupied territory. I don't want to go in there to not stir stuff up. But then I was invited in one time, and I was surprised. Like I was like, man, there's like, this looks kind of like chill, you know, this looks kind of chill in here. And then when they were another time when I was passing through there, like after they were, what was it? They were getting ready to sweep it. Like you just saw like it was this white lady, an older guy and like a kid in there. It looked like they were just packing up. So it's like there was this thing you were thinking there was, and they could have been like anybody from any, you know, high walk of life, you know, I don't want to say they had money. They looked like they had money, you know. And so I'm like, okay, you know, the media were saying like, oh, there's all these like, pardon my French, all these scumbags, whatever, you know, these negative thoughts. And I'm like, dude, these like, you don't actually know who the frick is back here. Yeah. Like, you're speculating, you know? But I didn't know, like, because I'd never been back. I didn't spend a lot of time back there, but that really opened my eyes when I passed through, and I was like, wow, I'm seeing just these vanilla, people. This vanilla family back here.
Look, could be living behind a white picket fence. That standard classic American kind of look is what you're saying.
I mean, something like that. Yeah, very
they just
basic,
look at
yeah.
that average, you know.
I mean, what is average? What is standard normal? I don't know. They didn't look like what the right wing people, what the big media was like trying to portray as what was back there. I mean, you're thinking of people with just dirty clothes, you know. And I mean, I'm not trying to say anything bad about anybody that was at the camp, you know. I don't want to disparage those people. I'm just saying that they were getting a bum rap in the media is what I'm trying to say, you know. Whoever was, because I don't know those people personally, you know. Like, yeah, they were just, whatever it was, the media wasn't doing a good job.
Yeah.
Sorry to go off on that tangent, but I just had to get that
actually,
off my chest.
Actually, coverage...
as a freelance journalist, we kind of appreciate that opinion. That's sort of why we invited you on the podcast here. To share with us your perspective.
See, and I was there for one day eviction and all that, and I remember exactly what you're talking about. It was a lot of, like, families and mostly Caucasian whites. And then all of a sudden, like, just before the eviction, like, somewhere around 11 midnight the night before, all those people started to disappear, and most of the camp was Antifa members and other left-wing protesters that were not going to give up position.
The hardcore ones.
Yes, the ones that were going to stand up. And then...
And there's a lot of them.
I remember Joey Gibson and all those guys showing up on that last night around midnight, 1 o'clock, and starting shit with all those guys there, and Andy Ngo was in tow. So, you know, and that's kind of one I wanted to jump to, too.
That's probably a good, nice last little topic, because I know you have been curious to chat with Mike about another supposed journalist or not journalist. There's been a lot of talk in the media with the way that Andy Ngo covers or chooses not to cover things and the way that he splices the narrative. So why don't you take it in, Corey?
Yeah.
Well, you can say that he's just been wrong sometimes. He's just wrong.
Okay.
Not all the time. He's a good journalist when he wants to be, and he has been in the past. What he's doing right now, you know, is mostly not journalism. Because, well, and some of it, like I try not to lean on other people's work too heavily, but he's probably leaning on other people's stuff too heavily, doing the embedding other people's videos in his stuff and commenting on it. That's like commentary, analysis, opinion. That's mostly not news. I mean, and I do a lot of that too, but when I report, it's reporting.
And it's labeled in the exact section it needs to be, if it's an op-ed, if it's a news analysis or whatnot.
See, not labeling that is something that I've run across people definitely discussing.
I don't want to say like conflict of interest or whatever, but we were like, we were in student media together. Like we rolled to Olympia together. There was this thing when that he wore the Muslim garb, the woman Muslim garb. I don't know what it's called.
Hijab.
Something.
Hijab.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was one of those something or other. Anyway,
he put that on.
I just don't want to say the wrong one just because I'm, you know, I don't want to say, you know, the, I love you, Corey, good guy. what is it? So he put that on there. The word went out, you know, we were kind of freaking out because we were like, oh, crap, you know. He put that on, did a piece on it. It ran in the Vanguard. You know, he'd been kind of making waves, and my editor at the back of the time, Alex Gowson, he's like, okay, we got to, like, distance ourselves from Andy Ngo because he's putting the heat on us. He didn't elaborate. I know he didn't want to, you know, Alex, he didn't want to, you know, F up his cushy, well-paid job there, you know. So, and me, I'm just like, you know, I'm the rebel. I kind of do what I want. Mike does what he wants to do, you know, when he wants to do it. So I'm like, shit, I'll chat this guy up a protest. You know, like I had sushi with that guy. You know, we rolled to Olympia together once for it was for a Patriot Prayer thing. It was back when that whole, you know, at the Evergreen. Remember when that thing was going on at Evergreen with those, what is it? I can't remember the name of the professors, but there was two professors up there that was really controversial. So we went up there for that, and like I felt like I talked him into it. I was like, "Come on, man, let's roll," because like I don't got a ride, you know. I know this is your thing, you know. I mean, it's my thing too, but it's his thing, but just in a different way.
The nationalist, the white nationalist.
And then, but then back then, I would still consider him a journalist. What he was doing was journalism largely. I mean, me and him, we were kind of similar in that we were both doing our own thing while we were double dipping, essentially doing our thing with the student media and doing our own freelance thing, which a lot of people don't Corey, you're doing that right now, actually.
Kind
of. Corey's double dipping.
I'm more than double dipping. I'm quadruple dipping. So.
But yeah, you know, stuff like that. Just so we were doing that. So I don't have a ton to say about Andy Ngo other than really he's, like I said, he's a good journalist when he wants to be. He got an award for doing a really good article that was the best article that Vanguard had had that I'd ever seen in the Vanguard on apostates, on Muslim apostates. But then again, their leadership wasn't the best leadership over there, so I don't know what editorial standards that article was held to, but it won the top award in its class. Like, basically, you'll see those pictures of the Vanguard holding like 20 awards up.
Oh, the ONPA awards.
Yeah, the one Andy got was the most prized one.
Okay.
But he wasn't in the picture.
Huh.
And I think he was either. I don't believe he was fired yet. I think he was almost fired. But
So how do you feel about a freelancer or self-titled journalist or reporter who tries to cover something like a protest and does not make a point to clarify every time they put out information from that protest that they were not there, were not present, and they also fail to attribute where they sourced the information that they are putting out there as they're attempting to cover that protest from a distance?
I mean, what it goes back to, I mean, that's not good. That's like a definitely negative thing, what you just said, Leslie. But what it goes back to is Portland State does not have a proper journalism program. So you're getting these people in like me. Like when I first started there, I pitched to, people, and I didn't have the first clue about reporting. You know, it was like blind leading the blind up there at the Vanguard in regards to student media. And, some of the people, they do good, like Riaz. Man, I love Riaz. I feel like he was instrumental in what I was doing. He taught me basic features on the iPhone that I would not have known how to do.
He's still there. He taught me videography and photography and the rule of thirds and whatnot.
He's great. But like the thing is Riaz can only do so much, you know, for us. He can only, you know, guide us so much. We need a proper, PSU needs a proper journalism program so that we can, get all the standards and just, here's the thing, like you don't necessarily need a journalism program. I didn't need one. What I did was I sought out an internship. You know, Eugene Weekly, you know, was nice enough to have me down there. And I, you know, they showed me the ropes, like grilled me, told me like, you know, Mike, this isn't going to work. You know, you need people who are just going to be brutally honest with you. And it's just baby steps, you know. You can't really get the fundamentals of reporting at Portland State. You have to seek it out for yourself. And I don't know if Andy sought that out, but
One thing I can say about the whole journalism at Portland State is actually between the University of Oregon, Oregon State University, and Portland State University, there is what is known as a non-competitive curriculum clause. So if one of the schools teaches like journalism as a major, the other school can teach it as a minor, and the other school can't teach it at all. So University of Oregon has a school of journalism.
So
Oregon State University has a minor program for journalism. Portland State doesn't have any.
Yes.
Portland State doesn't have any. But there is actually a teacher on campus right now. His name is Eben Pendyke, and he started teaching there back in spring of this last year. And I took his media writing class, and I had taken it a second time already. And yeah, it was actually really good. And I talked him into pretty much staying there, telling him, hey, dude, we need an actual media writing journalism program, something. And he's like, well, I love teaching here. Honestly, there's so many students that are just really interested about the different topics around town. And so he's decided to stay. He's moved here.
I would say, like, what I meant by blind leading the blind, you know, I wasn't trying to insult anybody with the visual impairment. I wear glasses. I can't see well without my glasses. but what I mean was, is like, you've got people like me, you know, I pitch to a person who's going to say, no, Mike, that story sucks. And it's like, well, you don't know the first thing about reporting. And I didn't either, but I'm trying. And, like, you know, somebody who maybe hasn't been, like, trained or knows what a good story is, when somebody tells you it's not a good story, you know, you'll think, oh, bullshit, I know that's a good story, you know, so I'll just, you know, get it off somewhere else. And so, like, yeah, and, like, I never wanted to take on, like, I was the news manager for the Pacific Sentinel, which was essentially, like, the second in command. But I had no aspirations to run a paper there because I just know there wasn't the institutional support.
Yeah.
You didn't have kids who really know what they were doing. I don't want to call them self-centered, but it's like, if you're going to do a news story, you know, don't talk about you. You know, it's not about you, you know, generally. And if it is about you, it's like, you know, whoa, what happened? Why is it about, you know, did you get beat up or whatever?
And I've only done that myself in one article, and it was a self-reflection on leading a team that was doing the Portland Street Response surveying for the homeless.
And sometimes you can't insert yourself into the article, but in like the right, you know, like I queued off of the Oregonian once. This guy there, he referred to him, this reporter referred to himself as like, what is it, like this reporter in the article. So I did that once. But if you look at my old stuff, it was almost like, you know, it was as much about me as it was what was going on, because I'm thinking about how I'm thinking, feeling, my reactions. And then as I go along, like now I look back at those articles and I think those are terrible articles. Mike, your early articles suck, Mike.
And, oh, so you're not a fan of gonzo journalism?
No. I'm a fan of old school, just facts. If you're going to do analysis,
okay,
do it, but maybe do it separately or don't have it lean heavily on that and have it be like where it's you can't argue against what you're saying. But yeah, like Portland, there's a lot of things wrong with the journalism at Portland State. And yeah, so I mean,
it does need a little bit of help in my opinion as well. I'm pretty much stepped away from it, actually. Working more with Village Portland and KBOO here.
All right, Mike. This has been a nice hour-long conversation with you. But I think it's time to wrap it up because I think we all have a few things to do.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't want to keep the listeners too long.
Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening.
KBOO Portland.